everyone. This is Julie Wake from the Arts Foundation of Cape Cod. Welcome to Season 6 of the Creative Exchange Podcast. We continue our celebration of artists, arts leaders, and the brilliant minds shaping the creative landscape. From painters to performers, writers to visionaries, we delve into the diverse world of creativity to discover what it truly means to be an artist in today's dynamic and ever-evolving landscape. I hope you'll join me on this creative journey. And if you like these conversations, leave a rating or a review, share with a friend, help us shine a bright light on our creative corner of the world here on Cape Cod. We'd like to thank our sponsor, William Ravis Real Estate, as the official real estate company of the Arts Foundation. We'd like to thank our sponsors, the Cape Cod Melody Tent, the Kelly Foundation, the Woods Hole Foundation, and the Cape Cod Foundation. We couldn't do it without your support. We'd like to thank Bank 5 and the Cooperative Bank of Cape Cod. Thank you for supporting the arts. Welcome to Season 6 of the Creative Exchange Podcast. We are thrilled to kick off this season with a special episode recorded at the Mass Cultural Council's offices in Boston. Our guest for today's episode is none other than the Executive Director of the Mass Cultural Council, Michael J. Bobbitt. Michael is a multifaceted talent with a career spanning theater direction, choreography, and playwriting. He has dedicated his professional journey to arts leadership and took on the role of executive director at the Mass Cultural Council in February of 2021, making him the highest ranking cultural official in the state of Massachusetts. In this interview, we delve deep into Michael's creative spirit and his remarkable journey as a leader. We'll discover how his lifetime of experiences has uniquely prepared him for the position he holds today. Get ready for an authentic and inspiring conversation with the one and only Michael J. Bobbitt, the driving force behind Massachusetts' cultural scene. Superhero.
Oh gosh, that's hard. A Wonder Woman. And I really wanted an invisible jet when I was a kid, and I was mad at my parents because they couldn't get it for me. I also was Wonder Woman for my 8th Halloween, and I used to wear my bracelet and lasso when I was hall monitor. It was very serious.
That's serious. Guilty pleasure.
So delicious. Ice cream, which is not dairy. It's dairy-free, but it's heaven. There's a salted caramel one made out of cashew nut as a base. Mm-hmm. Guilty pleasure.
Mm. Podcast. Besides ours.
Political. Right. This is great. Political podcasts. Morning Joe, Rachel Maddow. The night. I just love them. It's my way of getting the update on what's happening in the world.
It doesn't give you any anxiety.
No, I have a pretty intense self-care practice. So I take it in for information and have some big breaths and some meditation and then go on with the day.
Mm-hmm. Binge watching.
Everything. mostly I'm obsessed with maker shows. So any TV show where a group of artisans, be it drag queens, jewelry, home designers, cooking shows, where they're given a task at the beginning and then I have to complete the task. And there's this thing at the end. I'm obsessed with those. So any of those, you'll watch me watching. And I also really bad at watching sort of summer reality TV romance shows like Bachelor in Paradise. And I don't know why.
Fascinating. How about Project Runway?
Love it. My favorite.
Obsessed.
Well, I think RuPaul's Drag Race and Project Runway are probably my favorites.
Yeah. Oh, so good. So good.
The art is so high on both of those.
So, especially the latest one, Project Runway.
Oh my gosh. killer.
They're so good. Yeah. And they all get along and there's no stress.
I want the behind the scenes though.
Are you watching that one with Christian?
I didn't watch that. I know he's got the follow up. I should watch it.
Yeah. And then I'll text and discuss. Okay. okay, my last question. Now just wait, let me finish. Red Sox, Patriots, Celtics, Broadway.
Broadway, the Rockettes.
Yes.
I don't know. I don't even know what those are. They sports?
Yes.
Sports ball?
Sports ball. Okay. I heard you say something about I hate sports ball. So I had to throw it in there because I thought it was so funny.
Yeah. So my.
I feel the same.
My godfather was sort of unofficial mascot for the Washington football team when they were called the Redskins. And so I had to go to several games. And he always got his ass kicked by other fans. And it was always cold and we never had seats. And then going into the locker room, not understanding my own sexuality was like this trip thing. And so it just was like this traumatizing thing. And then my family so loved the Washington football team that the week prior, there was all this excitement and people were betting and gambling. And then if we lost, it was a week of depression and anger. And so it just became this thing that I'm like, I don't know if I like this thing.
Yeah, I agree with you. I watched my family go mental bananas every Sunday, and especially when the Patriots would make it to the Super Bowl. I was like, I need to move out. I don't get it. And going to a game was no thanks.
Every time my mom made me go out and play with your brothers, I would break something. And so at one point she said—
Like a limb?
Like a limb, a wrist, both my collarbones, because one time someone threw the football at me and I knew that at some point a bunch of kids would tackle me.
Yeah.
And so I got to the point where I would catch the ball, close my eyes, scream and run. And one time I ran into a tree, broke both my collarbones. So I don't like sports ball at all. Yeah. I appreciate the entertainment value. I know that it makes money for people and people feel a connection to their community because of it.
Yeah.
But it's not me.
No, same. I sometimes am a little envious of that connection that people have over sports. But then I find myself in my own world of arts and culture and I...
Waiting for the halftime show.
Yeah. Yeah, waiting for the halftime show or the pre-show or the walk-in or something more like, I don't know, creative.
My kid, huge athlete. He played every single sport. And when he...
Was that hard?
It was because I was bored to tears. Yeah. Trying to root for him and support him. And, but bored to... And also... You know, scared about it all because people and the injuries. But I remember going to a wrestling match, and within the first 5 seconds, the ref blew the whistle, and he said, "We got blood." And I look at my kid, and blood is gushing out of his nose. And I'm thinking, okay, it's over. Great, we're going home.
Yeah.
He grabs tissue, stuffs it under his nose, and then go back into the game. And I'm like, what is this? And so I started watching him wrestle like a scary movie, my eyes covered with my hands peeking through occasionally.
Yeah.
But he loved it and he found connection and his best friends are all kids he played sports with. So there's value. There's a lot of value in sports.
There is. There is a lot of value. We don't always all fit in.
Nope.
But it is definitely something of value. I agree with you. Tell me a little bit about where you grew up.
Washington, D.C., Lower Northwest, D.C., born and raised. My family migrated from South and North Carolina in the sort of 1960s when there was that second large migration as Jim Crow was ending and the Civil Rights Movement was happening. They all settled in D.C. And I grew up near Howard University, which felt like a castle to me. Like it was
I
this
bet.
Space on a building. I didn't really know what it was, but it was this thing. And so that was interesting. But I went to DC public schools through eighth grade and then transferred. I got recruited into an all-boy Jesuit college preparatory school.
Fascinating.
Which was really my first time experiencing sort of white culture on a day-to-day basis. Everything else was. I mean, my schools were predominantly black. I think I maybe had two white teachers in my public school days. Mm-hmm. But I found it's all useful. It all informs who I am. But I love D.C.
I love D.C. too. Yeah. And how did that inform, you know, did your family go to college? Was this something that... Yeah, I'm first-gen college, so I always love that question about, you know, how did you find your way into, you know, kind of getting on that track? And it sounds like the prep school.
Yeah, helped. Yeah, that was right. It was very interesting because in middle school, which we call junior high school, there was a program from the Archdiocese who managed a bunch of schools where they would pull kids from the public schools and take them and do evening classes in certain basic education skills like reading, writing, and arithmetic is what we called it back then.
Yeah.
And so they recruited kids from those programs to go to their high schools. Mm. And so me and two of my brothers were in that program. And when they recruited us, my brothers did not want to go to an all-boys school. And so they chose to stay in public school.
But you did? I did.
I chose to go. Yeah. And actually what was interesting is that I was going to go to Duke Ellington School of the Arts.
Oh, interesting.
And I remember my middle school band teacher, I went to him and said, hey, I'm really want to go to Duke Ellington School of the Arts, but this high school has recruited me. And he said, you're an artist. I think you will be an artist, but this is a great opportunity. You should go to that school. And so I listened to him and went there, and it exposed me to other cultures. It was rigorous academically. A lot. I mean, it's funny. I'm taking a math class right now, and I called my friend from high school and said, help me figure this out because this doesn't
make
any sense.
You're taking a math class?
I am. I never finished my undergrad degree.
Oh, okay.
So I'm finishing it now because
the state. Good for you.
Yeah, the state has a really great tuition remission program.
So why not?
Finishing it up, and then I'll start my master's, hopefully in the fall, which I'm super excited about.
I love that you shared that.
Yeah, yeah.
That is fascinating because you really have done so much, and to be in the position that you're at right now, and I admire that
Thanks.
You just shared that, so...
Yeah, so
you're going back.
I'm going back. So my mother did go to 1 year of teacher's college.
Okay.
But none of us finished college. And so my nieces and nephews are the first to finish college. So
that's
there are
cool.
many generations. So I'm kind of excited about also finishing college soon. And then if I time it right, I may get my master's at the same time my son gets his master's, which I think would be really cool.
So cool.
And we're going to go backpacking in Japan once that happens. Or audition for Amazing Race.
That's
the other.
Not Survivor.
Well, it's Amazing Race is usually
You could do pairs.
A couple of pairs.
That's right.
So that's why we want to do that.
Oh, that would be cool.
Yeah. Yeah. But I'm digging school. It's so much easier to learn 31 years later.
Mm-hmm.
The information is landing more because I have dozens of anecdotes about the theories that I'm learning. So it's a very interesting time.
Yeah. I went back to school to finish my degree too, much later. And I went to the Mass College of Art and Design here in Boston. And it was definitely a different experience to be in. They call us non-traditional students during the day, you know?
Yep.
And I felt like I feel like I added a lot of value to the conversation because I was there with kids that were just out of high school and, you know, and some of them from just all over the world in my class. I was in the architecture department and it was just such a good experience. I wouldn't change a thing. So I used to beat myself up about not finishing traditionally, but I wouldn't change a thing now.
Yeah. It's interesting because I've taught as a lecturer, adjunct professor, and associate for many different universities.
I love it.
Without the degree.
Then why did you feel the need?
I like professional development. I mean, throughout my year, I've done a lot of self-directed learning and, and you know, year-long programs or week-long intensives or my own sort of learning and online stuff. So I thought, why don't I put this all to use and get a piece of paper? Why not? And plus, because this, I, professional development to me is so important, especially for people in the arts. And so if the opportunity is there and the state, Massachusetts, is such a great state to work for and with the tuition remission program, why not do it? I'm also not running a nonprofit. It's a busy job. Running a state agency, but they're different things. Like, I don't have a board of directors to manage. We have a governor-appointed council, but it's much less time. I'm not raising money, which is, you know, was 10 hours of my week, 20 hours of my week. It's not a theater, which meant I had evenings and weekends to go to work. And so there's a lot more. I mean, I'm used to an 80-hour week, and now I have a 50-hour week. So why not throw another 8 hours and get a degree or two?
Yeah, I love it. I love that. Tell me a little bit about, you and I just recently had a conversation, and I'm going to make you repeat it, when you were at the Creative Exchange Conference. And you shared a little bit about your timeline of where you've been and what you've done. And I think connecting all of what you just shared with that would be, is really interesting. Will you tell us a little bit about your kind of career timeline?
Yeah, so the love of the arts started in elementary school. I kept doing it throughout high school. In high school, I did the plays, and then I was in the National Symphony Orchestra's Youth Fellowship Program. I was a trumpeter, and I actually got to college on a trumpet and academic scholarship. I know, most people don't think of that.
It's awesome.
I was training to be a classical trumpeter. That was my trajectory. And at the NSO, I got to get free private lessons with NSO trumpeters and conducting lessons with Mstislav Rostropovich and master classes and sit in on rehearsals with the National Symphony Orchestra and play with them. It was this rich, rich, rich experience. I realized a couple of years into college that classical trumpet was not my calling. I didn't know what to do, so I actually left school and went back to D.C., and for about 8 months, I just worked a little bit. And my plan was actually to go to a different school to continue studying trumpet, because I thought, might as well finish. And then I remember how much I loved dance, and so I started training at the Washington Ballet and the Dance Theater of Harlem and thinking about dance as a career. And then I realized classical dance is not, my body's not designed for classical dance, so I moved over to musical theater. And I went to a few musical theater academies, the American Musical and Dramatic Academy and CAPS 21 to get my musical theater training. And then in my 20s, I basically toured the country in shows and a couple of things internationally, a lot of regional theater, some summer stock. And I finished a tour in 96, moved back to D.C., got mixed into the D.C. theater community as a performer for the most part. Did a bunch of modeling on the side to make ends meet. And then my ex and I decided to adopt a baby. And when the baby came home, I realized that I did not like missing cuddle time at night. When you're in a show, the baby's going to bed while you're dancing and singing. And so I retired from performing and focused on teaching, and then eventually got some work directing and choreographing, which led to a part-time job at the Smithsonian. So I worked in museums as the director of their touring productions. I got to take museum exhibits and turn them into living stage plays and tour them all over the region.
This is crazy because what you're describing is all the training for this job.
For this job.
Yeah. So keep going.
Yeah. Museums, dance, music, theater. I did it all.
Trumpeting.
Yeah. Yeah. And a strong arts background in my high school, too. So I did a lot of painting and clay work and stuff. So then I was working at the Smithsonian, and I decided, someone said to me, you should run a theater company. And I was like, I don't know what that means. And so because I like self-directed learning, I started learning everything about running a nonprofit, from governance to finance to fundraising to HR to programming. And I joined a couple of boards to kind of figure out what that looked like from the inside. Mm-hmm. And I joined a board for a theater called Adventure Theater, which was a community theater, volunteer run. They were finishing up a capital campaign, and their goal with the campaign was to professionalize the organization, to turn it from a volunteer-run model to a staff-run model. And so the then president of the board said, you should put in your bid to do this job. And I was like, sure, that sounds cool. I did. They hired me. And so massive learning to get on the job, to really learn how all the things I had been studying came together. And also, from the transition from a volunteer-run model to a full staff-run model was a masterclass in managing people and change management, and how do you capitalize and finance this product that you have. Mm-hmm. And then during that time, if there was something I didn't understand, I would dig in from an educational perspective to learn it, learn the techniques behind it, and I had great mentors. The other thing is that during that process of running Adventure Theater, I got very involved in the community. And there's a culture in the sort of DMV, DC, Maryland, Virginia world, maybe because of our close proximity to the federal government, but it's all about who you know.
Oh, yeah.
People do business with people they know. And the community there gets heavily, heavily, heavily involved in what's happening from an advocacy and from a statewide or a countywide area. It's a lot different than it is up here in Massachusetts. I'm hoping to bring that to our arts and culture sector. But if you didn't show up at the legislative breakfast, your arts colleagues were calling you saying, where were you? We needed you there. Why weren't you there? Testifying at the State House, building relationships with senators and delegates and congresspeople, helping to draft and write bills, being on the advocacy board, being on the Arts Council board, all of that I was doing to advance my theater company. I didn't know it was preparing me for this job.
This job.
Yeah. And so that's what I did. So I did that for many, many years. And when my kid was approaching graduating, my new partner said, it's time for you to move on. Like, you've taken this organization where as far as it can go. I was on national boards, and I just did a whole bunch of stuff while I was there. At that theater company, we commissioned 45 new works from Tony-winning and Grammy-winning playwrights. We toured 5 shows nationally and 1 show internationally. We transferred 2 shows off-Broadway. We got a lot done. So I was freaking out about making another change. And he said, you can do it. And so I started taking calls from search firms. And I had a few offers, but the one that seemed the most appealing to me because of where I felt I was New Repertory Theater, which sadly announced its disclosure yesterday, dissolving yesterday. But I thought, I can come up here and learn something in a new environment. And I did. Did it for 17 months, and then got a call from the search firm that was looking for the new executive director for Mass Cultural Council.
And we're so lucky.
I feel lucky. It's such an enriching job. It's a really great job.
I bet. Yeah. I bet. So a couple questions about what you learned about leadership along the way. I'm very curious about, because I love you present so well. I love hearing you speak. I'm almost like in a trance, like, okay, what's next? But I'm really curious what you learned along the way for leadership and what you might share about running these different nonprofits, knowing, like, you know, you've been in our shoes.
Yep.
And so what kind of advice would you say for leadership, and then also, like, what should we be preparing for?
Yeah.
And I think your point about advocacy is critical.
Yeah. You know, I think I have lots of opinions about the arts sector, this sector that I love and call my family. So from a leadership perspective, I do think that leaders have to be willing to put unpopular opinions on the table and know that you might be persecuted for that opinion. You live on an island. You're in your own world. Everyone's looking at you for the answer and also looking at you and blaming you for the problems. And so one of the big things I say to people, leaders have to take care of themselves. Mm. You have to have a really rigid self-care practice so that you can get all that stuff coming at you all day, every day, and still be healthy. The other thing some of the things I practice is, you know, my mantra that people do business with people they know. I think it's important for us to get away from our offices, get away from our studios and our rehearsal rooms, and get into community. The arts touches every aspect of life. And so we should be at healthcare summits and summits on education and the town hall meeting about transportation and in the room with the real estate development people, because all of that affects what we do. Mm-hmm. In addition to getting them to know us, which is really important, you're going to attract board members, you're going to attract new donors and new patrons. You may find information about the way they do business that could help you and your business. But the big important thing for me is that we're using creativity to infect, and I use that word purposely, but to infect other people's minds to the value of creativity. It is creativity that's going to solve the world's problems. Mm-hmm. And if we're keeping it close at hand, if the sector segregates itself from other sectors, and even in the sector, we segregate ourselves within the sector.
Totally, yeah.
We're going to struggle. And I, you know, for a sector that contributes so much to the economic development of our country, of our cities, of our towns, of our state, for us to be, for the most part, all relatively unstable is something to think about. Mm. Is it them or is it us?
Right. Yeah. I mean, there's a constant conversation about the larger organizations versus the smaller organizations and funding, patrons, that sort of thing. I feel that that's the biggest challenge right now and the biggest equalizer is to be able to flip it.
Sure.
And at the Arts Foundation, that's something we're really thinking about and working with other funders, such as our community foundations and some other like private foundations to really think about, you know, who we're funding all the time.
Who needs your help the most?
Who needs our help the most, yeah. You know? And who has a safety net and who doesn't and who's making this impact with very little. It's just fascinating. I think the arts sector is so good at doing things on a shoestring budget. But if there's some sort of switch in the culture and the way we provide and prioritize funding for artists and small, you know, entities, it could be life-changing.
Yeah, and at the same time, we have to realize that even as funders, funding is not going to fix the systemic problems that we have.
Totally.
It's support, it's aid. Some even would call it welfare.
Yeah.
But it's not going to fix the problems. We have to focus on fixing the problems.
Mm-hmm.
And that means we have to get away from our desks. We have to speak with people that may have solutions outside of the sector. We have to ask for help.
Mm-hmm.
I think the interesting thing about large organizations is I think they are, in my mind, they are case studies for smaller organizations. Large organizations didn't start out large.
Right.
They started out with someone at a coffee shop going, I have this idea, and then they made it happen. So all organizations pretty much start small. So what can you learn from the large organizations? How can you use them as potential mentors and people to support the work you're doing? So, those are some things I would offer leaders, like take care of yourself, get away from your desk, realize people do business with people they know. And the last thing I would say is we've got to consider, especially in the art sector, we've got to consider that nothing that we have done in the past can be considered a sacred cow. We have to critically look at change and embrace change as part of our culture and become change friendly. We are, in fact, an organization that prides ourselves in creativity and innovation. We just don't use it in our business practices. We keep doing the same thing year after year after year after year and expecting a different result.
Mm-hmm.
We have to redesign some of the way we do our operations and our governance and the way we do our programming. We have to innovate.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard. For some reason, it's really hard. I don't know what that comes from. I wonder if there's a systemic problem in our schools that are training artists, because most of our arts leaders start off as artists, right? And usually you look at the curriculum, there's one business class.
Right.
When really all we do is a business. We're mm-hmm. all doing what entrepreneurs do. We create a product and then we try to sell it to people.
That's right.
And so we should have as many business classes as we have art classes. To me, it should be every semester you're having some class to help you with your business acumen so that we're not struggling with our business model, which I think is the biggest struggle that we have. It's not all external. We have to look inside mm-hmm. and say, what are we doing as a sector? What are we doing in our businesses that are keeping us from becoming really sustainable or
right.
even like abundant?
Mm.
It's possible. It's totally possible.
I believe.
It is totally possible.
Oh, that would be amazing, wouldn't it? To get rid of this scarce mentality of, you know, we're going to, you know, have a hard time, you know, planning out the next couple of years. The ideal would be that today you're planning for 2025, 26, you know, ideally, and the freedom that has and the less anxiety that leadership, that leader would have would be huge.
But at the same time, does it make sense to plan that far in advance?
Mm.
Like, I can't remember what the world was like 3 years ago.
So true. I know.
And the world is moving way faster. So why are we doing that? I mean, I think about during COVID, we all created quarterly budgets and then we pivoted when things changed. As soon as COVID ended, we went back to annual budgets, which is not done in the for-profit world. They have a roadmap, but they do quarterly budgets. Why are we doing annual? Why are my boards making me come up with a budget in February for a season that doesn't start till September and goes to the following August, a whole year and a half in advance?
It is so painful.
So painful.
Let's disrupt that.
It's about cash flows.
Cash flow.
Budgeting.
That's right.
So.
That is such a, that's an interesting idea to push because, I mean, for strategic planning, our strategic plan is a year.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because I don't want to plan strategically for more than that because it doesn't, you just never know.
Racial reckoning, pandemics. I think they're going to be locusts coming. I mean, it's going to be...
those tick-borne illnesses that are...
We have no idea what's coming. The downfall of democracy. I mean, it's planning that far in advance makes us not nimble.
That's right. And Mother Nature reminds us of that. Right? We're
going to be undersea using Uber dolphins to get to work.
That's an image. So we talk about self-care, and I know that there's a couple of things that bring you joy, such as your son and your family, so it's lovely to hear about that. But you also have your own creative endeavors. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I feel like I've gotten all the art out of my body.
Mm.
In many ways, I'm not necessarily pursuing artistic opportunities, but I am still sort of known in the theater world as a playwright. And so I have a few commissions that are in the works. I've gotten the rights to the Monster Mash and the whole estate of songs that Bobby Boris Pickett, who's from Somerville, the whole estate of songs that he wrote. So he kept writing monster novelty dance numbers. He's like, I got a hit. Let's just make some more. So in addition to the Monster Mash, there's the Transylvania Twist and the Sinister Stomp and the Werewolf Watusi.
Oh, totally. Yeah. Yeah. My kids love that.
So I have the rights to all of those songs, and I've made a whole new full-length Broadway musical out of that. So we're pitching it, and there's some people that are interested. I also, the theater that I ran in Adventure Theater in Maryland, and another theater I work with, Children's Theater of Charlotte, have commissioned me to adapt Mother Goose rhymes into sort of a mixed up new play. And so it's called Mother Goosed, which I'm super excited about. And then Our Gang, remember the Our Gang series mm-hmm. that became The Little Rascals?
Yes.
So I'm making a musical based on Our Gang. Spanky and Alfalfa and Buckwheat and Stymie. And,
oh, I loved that. Yeah. How would you change that?
I don't know. I mean, that's the interesting conundrum because, Eddie Murphy's characterization from Saturday Night Live made that character quintessentially a sort of a racist stereotype.
Totally, yeah.
But when you go back and look at the source material, it's 100 years old. Now, yeah. those stories, those
really?
Movies, yeah, those movies, those short films came out 100 years ago. It was right in the midst of post-Reconstruction, where some of the worst things this country has done to Black people were happening. It also was right in the midst of the Great Depression, but those movies the plot never dealt with race or poverty. It was just about the mischief and joy of childhood. And so my challenge is, can I write a musical that's just about the mischief and the joy of childhood without it having a deeper social meaning? And I want to try, because I do think we need a lot of joy in this world right now.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
And so that's what I'm working on, trying to figure out how to present these characters without them being considered racist or without it being something deeper.
Yeah, stereotyped and yeah. I saw your TED talk about the trauma.
Yeah.
Drama.
Yeah. Yeah. One of those.
Such an interesting topic and it resonated after because I was watching it and I was, I'm trying to kind of absorb what you're saying and I'm thinking, oh my God, yeah.
How many plays and movies do you see where people are
put in certain boxes?
Yeah. Or were we watching people be traumatized again?
Over and over again.
Yeah.
And I feel like there's a point in time to come back to a time where we're just telling a story to tell a story. And I miss those movies and those kinds of shows where it's just about community and friendship and the joys and the challenges and hardships of life that we all encounter.
We need a balance.
Yeah.
And I think, one of the things I love about art and artists is that our social justice lens comes through our art. And mm-hmm. so when we feel passionately about something or that something is wrong, our art will speak to that.
Right.
But our art can also speak to the joys of humanity and the positive things that we do and the contributions of people of color and marginalized people to our society. Mm-hmm. And I want more of that. I think that we as a society can learn to embrace each other more if more art reflected our contributions.
I love that. Is there anything I didn't ask you that you want to share?
No, just, our strategic plan is all about advancing the sector to the rest of the Commonwealth, building relationships with other state agencies and other sectors and meeting with secretariats. And I think some good things are going to come out of that. And I really hope that the sector is inspired by that and thinks about how they can do that in their own communities. Because I can do it on the state level, but I don't have the bandwidth to do it in every community and every region. And so I hope people will engage in that process.
I think they will. I know that we all look up to Mass Cultural Council to see, you're elevating the sector so much that we're waiting to see, how is this going to roll out and how can we support the sector throughout the Commonwealth and not just within my region. It's more of a perspective of like, let's do this all together.
Yeah.
So I can't wait to hear more about how it rolls out.
Yeah, and I think some of these relationships are going to put money directly into the pockets of artists and contracts and fees for services directly into the arts organization. So and from different sources, not just from arts funders and patrons, but from other government agencies.
Yes.
Yep. Major things happening.
I love it. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
And this was so nice. Thank you for the time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hosted by Arts Foundation's Executive Director, Julie Wake, the series is an ode to the artistic process and its unique manifestation on Cape Cod and beyond. Thanks for listening.